This is lesson number 4 in our book, Revelation Translation and Commentary, covering the first 3 chapters of the Revelation of Jesus Christ. Now we're down on page 27, this begins, middle of 27, where we had just mentioned the fact that the sixth world power was Rome. I think maybe I should digress just a moment on this, because a lot of you are going to get lost here. You're not familiar enough with world powers. God lists world powers in the relationship to Israel. And the first world power that oppressed the Jews was Egypt. And God brought them out of Egypt. And Egypt was reduced to virtually non-existent. And then the next world power to oppress the Jews was Assyria, and God put them out of existence. The next world power to oppress the Jews was Neo-Babylon, and they were put out of existence. And the next power that oppressed the Jews was Medo-Persia, and they were all but put out of existence, reduced to pretty much of nothing. And then immediately following that fourth world power, we picked up the fifth world power, Greece. And Greece was reduced to a non-entity for their oppression of the Jews. And Greece, until very recently, was totally absorbed under other countries. Greece was followed by Rome. Rome under the Caesars and Rome under the various rulers for a long period of time. Oppressed the Jews worse and worse, till God overthrew the Roman Empire for oppression of the Jews. The next world empire that rose in its place was the Vatican Empire, which is the seventh world power. Now, each of these has been overthrown, and the Vatican Empire will be no exception, as it too will go down to destruction. This is the way God has worked these nations, although he has permitted them to come on the stage of history. So I want you to just have that little much, a little bit on it. I can't go into it in great details because it's too big a digression. But we have plenty of courses on this, particularly the Babylon course and the Babylon book, which covers all of this material. But I need that little bit. And I'll comment on it again from time to time, because we are going in to get into it some. Now it says 10 days tribulation. There is no explanation of this statement if applied to a local church at Smyrna. You get that? There's no explanation of this statement, 10 days tribulation, if applied to a local church of Smyrna. But if Smyrna is symbolic of the suffering church, we have no problem. Clare's Library of Universal History, Volume 3, lists exactly 10 such intense persecutions. In AD 64, a 9-day fire destroyed 10 of the 14 regions of Rome. That was a colossal fire. Nero blamed the fire on the Christians. Here's a note right under that from Clare's. And the result was the first of the 10 great persecutions of the Christians under the auspices of Roman emperors. Now, this was the first of 10. You notice you had the expression, they'll have tribulation 10 days? Okay, these are 10 periods of Roman oppression. And Clare's Universal Encyclopedia of History, great big voluminous set, just actually spells them out. And it's not a Bible book, it's a history book. And it says, this is persecution 1, this is persecution 2. So if we will accept history, I always accept history as verification for prophecy. Prophecy is not given to make you and I fortune tellers, but prophecy is given so that we'll be able to study, look at these things coming to pass, and when they happen, we'll give God the glory. He's to get the glory. Now, the only way you'll ever acknowledge they came to pass is by your knowledge of history. This is why that I believe that probably at least 30% of the Bible is total blank to the average pastor and average congregation because of his lack of knowledge of history. He does not have enough history. And this is very sad that schools teach so little of the history of ancient times that would open to them an understanding of the prophecies. And that's really essential. So if you have a little history, you're all set. And this Encyclopedia of History just spells it out, and it says it's the first. The second great persecution was under Domitian, A.D. 70. The third was under Trajan, A.D. 116. The fourth was under Adrian, A.D. 135. The fifth was under Marcus Aurelius, A.D. 178. The sixth was under Maximin, 235 A.D. The seventh was under Decius, 250 A.D. The eighth was under Gallus, 250 A.D. The ninth was under Valerian, 254 A.D. The tenth was under Diocletian, A.D. 303. Thus we see this church period existed some 230 years. It was marked by death. You be becoming trustworthy unto death, it said Revelation 2:10. The crown of life. Now we want to look at that a minute. Stephanos is the word crown. There is another word translated crown, diadema. Diadema, crown, is what the word we get diadem from. And this is the crown which you see the popes wear with a tiara, but its original meaning was much more like you see the fellas wear around. The single band is a diadema. Now, if you understand the single band as a diadema, you can see how they can wear more than one crown, because it would be easy for them to wear two or three of those bands on their head at the same time, so they could be king of Assyria and king of Ethiopia and so forth all at once. They can wear those, because we're inclined to think of the great big high metal crown simply because of the Pope's tiara. But that's a tiara. That isn't really the word crown at all. The crown that we think of course, is perhaps more the British crown, where we see a crown with its jags around it, or the crown that they crowned the beauty queen with, or something of that sort. Well, that is not the original word diadema. Diadema is a narrow band, which you see many people wear on the street, many of them. They wear these narrow bands. That's a crown. And today it has largely come to signal a certain kind of rebellion. But that's what diadema was. Now, Stephanos was usually in a wreath form with leaves, perhaps flowers, branches of trees, and it was a victor's crown. It was given for running a race or for winning, like we would give the gold medal. As we talk so much about winning the gold medal at the Olympics, they would have won the wreath, the laurel crown. And this is the Stephanos. So there's two different words. All right, look at Isaiah 62 while you're at it. It's a good place. For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until her righteousness, look at this now, go forth as brightness, and her salvation as a lamp that burneth. And the nations shall see thy righteousness, and all kings thy glory. And thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of Jehovah shall name. Thou shalt also be a crown of beauty in the hand of Jehovah, and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. Thou shalt no more be termed forsaken, neither shall thy land any more be termed desolate, but thou shalt be called Hephzibah, and thy land Beulah. For Jehovah delighteth in thee, and thy land shall be married. For as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee. And as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. And so we find this word crown in the Septuagint, a crown of beauty applied to Jerusalem and Zion. And you see these things. So Israel is the bride. Down in verse 5, as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. Israel is the bride, and Jesus is the bridegroom. The New Testament body of Christ is never called the bride. That is pure, again, pure and simply robbing Israel of their blessing. It's not called the bride. The bride of Christ is Israel, and the body of Christ is the New Testament church. The New Testament church is not both. All right, now we come to Alfred's statement on Revelation 2:10 says, and that the imagery of this book is not anywhere drawn from Gentile antiquity, but is Jewish throughout. Now the commentators acknowledge this with no trouble. Now we come to verse 11. The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the assemblies. The one having victory, by no means might he be done harm out of the death, namely the second. Now, if you look at, well, you don't have, wait a minute, yes you do, you have an American Standard. I have my King James in too, but if you have an American Standard right there, it's in your, on that page. If he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches, he that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now that's a little bit more condensed than I've done it. If you look at the last sentence in the interlinear that I put at the bottom of the, with the lines under it, the one having victory by no means might be, it should be, might he be done harm. That's right, that's a he, I'm sorry. By no means might he be done harm out of the death, namely the second. That's kind of putting it all out, stretched out there. But that's what you're talking about. And you see there in the printed, it can be condensed a little bit. All right, now we come to page 28A, and there we take a look at the Smyrna church. Now we know a lot more. That first church of Ephesus was Jewish. This one here is the suffering church. Gentiles are being added. See the top of the circle. Gentiles are being added now. Cornelius has had the outpouring of the Holy Spirit at his house, and Gentiles are now coming in number. The introduction at the first speaks of the one who was dead and lived again, and so points to the cross. Now, the good things down the left-hand side, I know thy tribulation and thy poverty, and then we come to fear not the things which thou art about to suffer. Behold, the devil's about to cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. Now notice James 1:12. And James 1:12, by the way, is to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation. Now see, temptation is the same that ye shall be tried. Now I put them up there, referring the one down to James and the other one right across there into verse 10, so that you could see them one above the other, that those first letters, that's a pi, epsilon, iota, rho, alpha, are alike. See, one is the verb, perazo, and the other, perazmos, is the noun, endure temptation. For when he hath been approved, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord promised to them that love him. And I've shown there a little crown. Now down at the bottom of the page, I have the one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And I have a figure this time I cut out with a crown as a figure taken from an ancient Greek vase of a victor of a race. And he's awarded this kind of a crown. That's what we're talking about when we talk about Estephanos. Now, coming back to the left side, tribulation 10 days. Now, for your convenience, I have spelled it out right down there. Nero, Domitian, Trajan, Adrian, Marcus Aurelius, Maxim, Decius, Gallus, Valerian, and Diocletian. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 periods of persecution. Now there's a lot bad here. Look at the right. And the blasphemy of them that say they're Jews, they're not, but are synagogue of Satan. Ye are of your father the devil. We had that verse before, you remember, on an earlier page. Well, I put it in here so as to chart these things for you to better see. Now, in Matthew 13, we have a series of 7 parables. And I propose to show you before we get finished that the 7 parables parallel the 7 churches. All right, look at this one for a minute. Then he left the multitudes and went into the house, and his disciples came unto him, saying, explain to us the parable of the tares of the field. And he answered and said, he that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man, and the field is the world, and the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy that sowed them is the devil, and the harvest is the end of the world. And the reapers are angels. As therefore the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be in the end of the age should be. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, they shall gather together out of his kingdom all things that cause stumbling, them that do iniquity, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He that hears, let him hear. Now, this parable in Matthew 13 speaks of the tares and the wheat we just talked about a few minutes ago in the nation of Israel. And this parallel to this thing is in this period, the wicked part, the synagogue of Satan, in the period of time when Gentiles are being added. And they offered a great deal of oppression to the church at this time. Now we have, after Diocletian, the Smyrna church, and that merges into the Pergamos church, and the Greek church is forming, and the Latin church is forming at this time. And I put a little picture of the Colosseum at the bottom, for here many were faithful unto death. I don't know how much of history you've ever read concerning the persecutions and the terrible inquisitions and these things, but I wish you could get every Christian to read them, and even to look at the pictures that have been drawn concerning them, and maybe Christians would think a little bit differently when they go to complaining, because these early Christians knew what it was to suffer. There isn't a soul here that's ever suffered. Oh, you think you may have had a little tribulation of one kind or another, little family problem or something or the other. These people knew what it was to suffer. It's hard to believe that in that arena area, or in arenas like that, they have been known to, they have all kinds of things, remember. They have combats where individuals fought individuals. They have exhibits where individuals fought animals. They have exhibits where the Christians were just thrown to the beast, some with defense weapons, some without. And they had all of these as spectacles, and I cannot, for the life of me, imagine how people could go and watch such a spectacle. I mean, I can't fathom how they could do this. But when you start to think of the corruption in our country and in our time, and the criminals and the murderers that are murdering a dozen and more people with no compunction, this thing is going on and on and on. When you think of this kind of a thing in our country, and you say, well, things are getting bad, just remember what it was at their day. For they have been said to have slaughtered 5,000 animals in one day's exhibition in the arena. And that, to me, is unbelievable. I cannot believe. And that people would be tortured. They were usually slaves that fought, but then there were professional gladiators. Now, the professional gladiators that were purely in it for what they could get out, I don't really care so much about. I mean, they went into it as a business, and just like you get killed in a wrestling ring. It doesn't bother me to watch wrestling, because after all, the fellow went in and on his own. If he gets his neck broken, that's his fault. He enjoys it. If he didn't enjoy having his neck broken, he wouldn't go into wrestling. So that's easy. But the majority were not that. The majority were people, slaves or whatnot, that were put in there. Maybe they were armed and then put in there and left to die or murdered or done to death one way or another. And I can't understand people, but that's what was going on. So don't talk about times getting worse. And above all, don't use world conditions as to the deplorable condition of man as a reason for it being the soon coming of the Lord. Because they could have used that and they would have been 2,000 years wrong. So that was a way, way back then, and theirs was much worse than ours. In fact, theirs was so deplorable that it caused the whole fall of the whole Roman Empire, and ours has got a little way to go before it causes the fall of the United States of America. But they finally get to that point, and then down they go. So it's very hard to believe this thing went on like this. All right, now I think we're up to the next verse, verse 12. And to the messenger of the assembly in Pergamum, you write, these things here, the one having the sword, namely the two-edged, namely the sharp, is saying. Pergamum or Pergamos means thoroughly. Per means thoroughly. Gamos means marriage. Thoroughly married. Since Satan's plan of persecution in the Smyrna period only to strengthen the church. Now, let me see if I can get this across by going a little slower. You see, in the first period, Satan raised up the synagogue of Satan and these Jews to protest against his saved Jews, those who came to know Christ. So that even Paul, who was a Pharisee, held the coat of Stephen while they were stoning Stephen. He held the coats of those round about them while they were stoning Stephen, I should say. And he took part in these things. So these people were used of Satan to oppress these new Christians. Now that didn't work. So as Gentiles began to come in too fast for Satan to cope in that manner with the Jews, he now tried his next one, and that was persecution. So he brought on these horrible 10 periods of persecutions when tens of thousands died. But that didn't work. That only strengthened the church. For the more persecution, the stronger the people grew, and the church multiplied exceedingly. I'm sure you've heard the story, it's a true story, I believe, of the Roman period, of the 100 men that marched on the frozen river at Rome, the Tiber. And they were marching down the river. They were stripped naked, and they were made to march on the ice. It was wintertime, on the ice, because they were Christians. And they marched down the road. It's a story I have trouble narrating, because I think of these things, and it tells us to look at these witnesses around us in Hebrews. Look at these witnesses and see what they went through, and then stop complaining. And let's go on for the work of the Lord. But those 100 men started down there on the ice, and they sang 100 soldiers marching for Christ. And every little way they had a big bonfire and new changes of raiment and all kinds of awards to get them to turn away from Jesus Christ. And as they got down the Tiber away, one soldier got very, very cold, and he pulled off to a fire. And one of the soldiers standing by the fire stripped his uniform, and he said, "There's still 100 soldiers marching for Christ," as he joined them. That's what it took, and that's what the early church did for the Lord Jesus Christ. And we bellyache and complain for nothing. All right, let's go a little further. He says here, Satan, I want to finish this. So Satan was trying to wed the church to his idolatrous system, and hence we pick up this name Pergamos, thoroughly married. Because he tried, when he couldn't persecute them and cripple the church that way, he then immediately began to try to infiltrate it and intermarry it with paganism. Get the idolatry things the same. I'm sure if you watch Life magazines when it was a lively publication, you've seen pictures. I've got some. Maybe sometime I'll put them up. And if you see these pictures, you'll see where the Roman Catholic Church sandwiches the two together. And they have a church with a cross and all of that. And then down on the steps, they offer sacrifices of chickens and all these kind of things. And all of the idols are brought out there and worshiped. They never converted the pagans of South America. The Roman Catholics of South America are not Christians. They're pagans. They're pagans celebrating half Christian and half other. They had a TV show just this past week when they showed one of these things in the You Asked For It series. And they showed how it's an intermarriage of paganism. Showed it right on the screen. They showed the crucifix and all of this, and intermarried with all of the voodoo that went with it. All showed it right on the screen. But people don't listen. But that's what's going on. All right, now let's move to the next little asterisk there at the bottom of verse 13. I know absolutely where you are residing, wherein which is the throne of the Satan. All right, the question is, where is Satan's throne? That's what we're going to talk about. And you are retaining my name, and you denied not my trust, also in the days of Antipas, my witness, my trustworthy one, who was killed beside you, wherein which the Satan is residing. This verse is very controversial. Commentaries are really quite without answers. Various commentators admit an insurmountable problem with Satan's throne in Pergamum. There's no way you can't put Satan's throne in Pergamum. There's no evidence it ever was there. As to Antipas, there are almost as many opinions as there are commentators, whoever he was. Nobody has the faintest idea. I'm going to try and solve all your problems right now. Revelation 1:20 told us the seven lampstands were part of a mystery. The word mystery occurs just four times in this prophecy. Revelation 10:7, the mystery of the God was finished at the sounding of the seventh trumpet. Revelation 17:5, mystery written on the forehead of a woman. And Revelation 17:7, the mystery of the woman. Understanding Pergamum as a small local church is hardly a mystery. 3. Why would Satan's throne be in Pergamum? 4. Why symbolically would thoroughly married fit a small local church? Satan's throne is, of course, symbolic of his power, enthroned in the sixth world empire, Rome. That's where Satan's throne was, with no question of it at all. It is in this period that Christianity and paganism were wed under Constantine, 324 A.D. We're going to bring you all the way up to the present church before you leave. All right, here we have it. Claire's History, page 1110. By this triumph over the last of his rivals, Constantine the Great, as he was now called, became sole sovereign of the vast Roman world. And under him, Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire. After he had personally embraced the religion of Christ, get that, and had thus become the first Christian empire, emperor, get that, with this important event, the history of pagan Rome ends and the history of Christian Rome begins. In the following section, we will trace the rise and progress of Christianity and its ultimate triumph under Constantine the Great. Now look across the page. In A.D. 324, Constantine the Great issued an edict exhorting all his subjects to follow his example by becoming Christians. He did not, however, proscribe paganism. As the office of Pontifex Maximus, which is chief bridge builder, the title of the Catholic Pope, by the way, which he held, required him to offer sacrifices to the heathen gods at Rome. Although he permitted his pagan subjects to exercise the religion without molestation, the emperor's example and the hope of gaining his favor induced thousands to renounce paganism and to embrace the religion of the cross. Now you see what kind of a Christian he was. Over here he was a Christian, and then he ran over here and became a pagan and offered all the sacrifices to the idol gods. Then he ran back and became a Christian, and then he ran back and became a pagan. So he was beginning the sandwich of paganism and the marriage of paganism with Christianity. And this was Constantine, and this is what he stirred up. And of course, from what we set as standards, we doubt very much, of course, that he was ever a Christian at all. That he was just called that. He nominally embraced it. All right, at this period, the church was residing in the Roman Empire, where Satan was truly also residing. If everything else is symbolic, why not Antipas? Why are we putting a capital on it and making it a person? I mean, you see, that's what's leading us off. Let's back down, put the letter down to a small a. Anti means instead of. Pas means all. Why? In the days of Antipas. What's that mean? In the days of Antipas. Anti can also mean against. Hence, Antipas could mean against all. The Council of Nicaea was summoned by Constantine in 325 A.D. Let me turn the tape before I get wound up on this.